This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Max Delight shot through, grabbed the lead. Max Delight wins it.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Very elegant. 10 group ones. And now the greatest of them all, the Melbourne Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Good morning, everyone. Been a busy week. I'm looking forward to this Saturday. We've got so much action ahead of us, not just today, but also in the week ahead in all three codes. It's a very exciting time of the year. Simone Fisher, good morning to you. And good morning to... Is that Matt?
It is.
Matt Stewart's joined us, Simone.
Hey, whoa, I'm usually here.
Well, that's... Yeah, usually.
I usually give you a note a week in advance. So, yeah, it's great to be here. Love being here. Ballarat Cup Day today, looking forward to that. That's sort of a hometown for me. I had a year at St. Pat's.
Is it?
Felt like a lot longer than a year.
You've got hometowns in nearly every town or city in Victoria, haven't you?
Who was the song, Wherever I Lay My Hat?
that's my home.
Do you wear a hat? Only when you've had a bad haircut.
I should.
Yeah, which was a couple of weeks ago for memory.
He
was wearing a hat.
1984, I reckon I was at St. Pat's for a year. That was a big year.
What happened? Did they kick you out?
No, they never did that. They asked students not to return so they wouldn't have an expulsion record. So my brother and I were politely asked not to return for a series of misunderstandings.
So you went when you said students, it was specific students.
I think Patrick Payne had a similar fate, and maybe also Robert Smurden, I'm not sure. But Ballarat, what an enormous epicenter it's become. It used to be when Noel Kelly was there. And we're going to have a chat to Mick McGowan. Simone's teed up Mick McGowan later, and he has a connection. I think he's related to Noel Kelly. And when Noel Kelly was the leading trainer in Ballarat, it was a sand track, a Mount Piscar in the background, and a course proper. And now Ballarat, as we're going to witness on Cup Day today, is this massive training and racing centre with 600 horses and just sort of the big little brother of Cranbourne now. So it's a big deal, Ballarat.
And about half of those horses are racing today of the 600. They're pretty big fields, as you would well expect at Ballarat. And I think it's zoneless for the first time today, Matt and Simone. So I think for the first time, particularly in any of the three codes, we're just seeing it getting closer to normal than we have in the last 18 months.
What's the de-zoning situation with the greyhounds? Do we know, Simone, how that's...
Look, I'm not sure.
It'll be imminent.
But, yeah, it will definitely happen. I think I was talking to Adrian Scott during the week from Sandown, and they had a set number for the Melbourne Cup next week, but they're just waiting on restrictions. They could possibly ease that. They didn't want to go and open it all up, and then something went wrong and they had to sort of backtrack. So they've got their quota, and there is a possibility that they may be able to allow more patrons in on Cup night this Friday night. And while we're talking about Sandown, just a shout out to Tony from Sandown, one of the workers. He listens to our show every week as he drives into the track at Sandown on a Saturday morning, and was listening to his boss on the radio last week. Didn't tell me whether he needed any critiquing or not, but shout out to Tony. It's nice hearing people say, I listened to your show and really enjoyed that guest, and you know, I'm in the car and I listen to it every Saturday morning. So we like hearing those type of things. So all good. So with Sandown and Melbourne Cup, it possibly could ease a little bit.
And of course, for everyone that we know that are listening to the show live on a 6 to 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, it's available on the website by podcast as well. So if, A, you want to hear something again, or something might happen, you sleep in, whatever it might be, you get the opportunity of getting onto the website for the podcast. And also on the Victoria Harness Racing Club website, the podcasts of all the
beautiful
Cracking the Code shows are there as well.
Beautiful, beautiful. That's fantastic to know. I tell you what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to this week, but I'm looking forward to leaping ahead to next week's Zipping. Look, I've been a staunch critic of the plonking of the Zipping meeting on Jericho weekend. I think Jericho had earned the right to that weekend and all the promotion because of how big I think it is and so on. But having said that, I think the Zipping, things are falling the Zipping's way. They've got the relaxed rules where there's no zones, the first normal big race meeting in town for 2 years where everything will feel normal, including not even wearing masks in bars and stuff. So that's going to be huge. The Spanish Mission story of him coming, as well as Surprise Baby, and then the return of Jamie Carr. I know she's only been away for 3 months, but she's such a big figure. The mainstream news is going to get hold of this. The return of Jamie Carr at the Zipping Classic is just a dream result for the MRC because they've taken a big gamble of repositioning and relocating the race. So I think everything's coming up zipping at the moment for the MRC and for racing, really, because Simone, it was a really big experiment to plonk it 3 weeks later than normal, take it away from Sandown and put it at Caulfield when the curtain had already been drawn on the Spring Carnival. So luckily for the MRC, it looks like things are going their way.
Oh, hopefully, and with the return of Jamie as well riding, I'm sure there's plenty of owners that will be happy to have her back on their horses. And look, it's one of those stories I haven't been covering or following it that closely, but obviously it's been one of the biggest news in racing since for years. And look, it's great that it's come this far and that she's back riding, because it's like good horses and greyhounds, isn't it? Good jockeys, we do want to see them win these big races or at least compete in them. So good news all round.
Absolutely. Dan, who are we yakking to this morning?
Well, you mentioned we're going to have a chat with Mickey McGuan. We can talk all three codes with Mick and also reminisce about his success with the Greyhound Fair Sentence and the 1989 Melbourne Cup Greyhounds. Of course, the feature Melbourne Cup Greyhounds race next Friday night. Tonight, we're talking about 8 Group 1s. It's Breeders' Crown Night at Melton. And shortly, we're going to have a chat with RSN's very own and most enthusiastic and most passionate harness racing supporter in Gareth Hall.
All right, it'll be great to hear from my teammate Gareth a bit later on in the show. But first up, after the break, football and three-code racing royalty, Mick McGuan.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
We are cracking the codes on this Saturday morning on RSN, and it's been a big week of racing, a big weekend and a big week coming up with, of course, the Melbourne Cup at Sandown on this coming Friday night. Can't wait to be out there. $500,000 to the winner of the Melbourne Cup this year. And it always sets me on a little bit of a path to find some previous winners and look into some of the history of the greyhounds. And something popped up on YouTube last week, and that was a little clip with Dan Malecki and also Mick McGuan and a couple of his footballing mates when their greyhound Fair Sentence took out the 1989 Melbourne Cup. So I went on a little bit of a mission to contact Mick, and he was very, very forthcoming. And it's been wonderful having a chat to him during the week. Someone that I feel that we've known each other but never actually had a conversation until prior to this. And I'm so thrilled that Mick McGuan is joining us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Good morning, Mick.
G'day, Simone. Absolute pleasure.
How are you, Mickey?
G'day, Matty. G'day, Dan.
How are you, Mick?
You've got your number one fan now.
Yeah, no, it's growing in Dawson, isn't it? No, she was fantastic, Simone. And when you talk about a greyhound of that status, just on 30 years ago, it brings back some great memories.
And the clip, there was even the bloke that was doing the interview looked like he could have been playing football with you at that time.
We both could have been still going around, I reckon.
Is it hard? Look, because you see that, don't you, when you see yourself from 30 years ago, and because your mind doesn't change, but a lot else does, doesn't it, Mickey and Dan?
Absolutely, it does, Matt.
And Matt.
Relaxation, I reckon. Sit back and let others do the hard work, mate.
There was at the time, Mick, there was a terrific photo on the front page of the Herald Sun with you, and it may have been Paul Hawke, you'll be able to tell us, and a greyhound, and all three of you looking so athletic. That was with Fair Sentence, I think. A terrific shot, and making it to the front page instead of the back page, that must have been one of the highlights of your career and also the greyhounds.
Yeah, we made the front page for the right reasons for a change, Simone.
That's right.
It was great for the greyhound industry at that time, because it put a lot of focus on the industry, but also the Melbourne Cup greyhound race. We know the Thoroughbred Melbourne Cup is the race that stops the nation, but at the time, to be front page of the Herald Sun, everyone bought the Herald Sun at that time. Nothing was online. It was just great to sort of showcase what a terrific industry the greyhound industry is. And the amount of people that come to the Melbourne Cup in 1989 was incredible. I remember speaking to Johnny Stevens post-race. He had a great career at St Kilda Footy Club, but he was synonymous with the industry at that stage. And he was a fantastic guy to talk to about the history of the sport, but also he was accommodating when it came to giving praise about what certain people, certain trainers do for the industry. And he felt at that time with Fair Sentence's ability as a greyhound, but also who was connected. And then that led to the Collingwood people supporting a dog they didn't even know. And the crowd that night at the Melbourne Cup was just incredible. They're hanging off the rafters. They're all there cheering the greyhound on. And there's no doubt we had a magnificent night because of it.
And making the Channel 10 news that night as well. So let's take a listen to this famous interview with Dan Malecki post-Melbourne Cup.
Footballers Mick McGuan and Paul Hawke, who part-owned last night's Melbourne Cup winner, Fair Sentence. But Dan Malecki reports after opening up in the red, Fair Sentence ominously started in black and white figures.
The Magpie support was with Fair Sentence because the Greyhound started a very short favourite from box one in the red.
Racing, Fair Sentence jumped out well on the inside of Gay Rajah, going very quickly on the outside was the Airbrander. The Airbrander in front. Fair Sentence got right up on the inside. LaDanza checking out the back. Fair Sentence a length in front. The Airbrander second, three lengths away. Gay Rajah running on. Off the back, Fair Sentence two lengths in front. The Airbrander coming again, three lengths away. Gay Rajah. A match in two. Fair Sentence in front. Two lengths clear of the Airbrander, trying hard. Fair Sentence in front. He's got the cup won. And Fair Sentence wins by three lengths. Second, the Airbrander, Gay Rajah. Third, then came...
Fair Sentence is part-owned by five people, including Collingwood football stars Mick McGuan and Paul Hawke.
Collingwood have never won trophies. They're going to love that.
Oh, yeah, might be a place in the mantelpiece for us, Dan, but, you know, we've persisted with the dog. He's been, you know, just terrific to be involved with, and our first dog, we couldn't... Just a dream come true, basically.
As big as, you know, perhaps playing in a, you know, premiership team for Collingwood?
Well, I think it's a different feeling, but, you know, we're certainly just as nervous, I think. I think I was probably worse than playing in that normal game for some reason. You know, it's just a race and just a dog, but...
Dollar terms, Hawkey.
That could be the reason. But all the luck went our way tonight. He made the front and he just stayed there.
Mick, when you listen to that, the replay and also the interview, does it just transport you back 30 years ago or roughly 30 years ago to that moment? Can you remember how you were feeling and the nerves and the atmosphere like it was yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely, Simone. It was one of those intriguing situations in the lead-up because the dog was starting to really hit his form. It was on the back of probably his Geelong Cup win. And then he, not long after that, took out the anniversary trophy at Olympic Park when he won by an ever-increasing margin of about 12 lengths. And Graham Bate, who took over the dog from Cesar Costa, he told us at the time he thinks this might be the best dog he's ever trained. So... with all that, it just built some pressure. But we also, or I actually, bought the dog in the Calcutta. And we felt at the time, if we could get him at the right odds, we'll buy him. Because if he happened to draw one or eight, and maybe if he drew one, draw inside the Airbrander, who we felt was a fantastic box dog, but also gave you some room at the start, this dog would probably be, you know, a 7 or 8 to 1 chance in the Calcutta. But if he drew correctly in the Melbourne Cup, he would be close to 6 to 4 or even money, which eventually is exactly what transpired. So going into the race after all that lead-up, that built pressure because we had him going for 21,000, then the prize money and all that sort of stuff. And back then, that was quite big money for, you know, five young blokes who just entered into the greyhound industry for the first time owning their first dog. But when we got to the night, I remember Batesy saying to us, I couldn't have the dog any better. This dog's ready to go. And... the rest is history. He jumped well. The Airbrander drew box three. As Dan said in his call, those two greyhounds were going head and head up to the winning post the first time. And we knew that the Airbrander would probably shift right and give us room to burrow underneath. This is exactly what happened. And the other dog that was probably the one that we had to concern ourselves with was Gay Rajah, who drew in between those two greyhounds. And he was hit and miss at the start. And when he missed the start, I thought after 3 or 4 strides, the race was over. Because once he got on the bunny, the greyhound very rarely got beat.
And those, it's probably long enough ago where you could actually go in and have a crack at the bookies ring, which seems like a million years ago, but there was probably enough bookies around to actually get a bit on there. Hey, Mickey, we were talking to Tom Hawkins during Cup Week about, you know, his connection with horse racing and so on, and I was thinking about it when Simone teed you up to come on, that I reckon... greyhounds obviously is a smaller code, but the representation of famous sporting people into greyhound racing is quite high, isn't it? I mean, Ricky Ponting, you, and Plugger. I mean, even just Plugger alone, like how big was it for greyhound racing that such a huge megastar as Plugger and you, and then Punter, were connected to greyhound racing and got a lot of enjoyment out of greyhound racing?
It was just great, Matt, because my granddad, my mum's dad, he was connected with greyhound training And as a kid, we used to walk the dogs with Granddad. We used to go to the old Broadway Park, Morshead Park days. You go and ask a trainer, can I catch your dog in the catching pen and get a dollar? So it was all that type of fun, racing into the catching pen to get the dog that you were given the task to catch and give it back as a handler to the trainer who put it in the box. So that was ingrained in me as a young fella because of my family, my mum's granddad. And I just fell in love the thrill of going to Ballarat Greyhounds on a Wednesday night. Then, because I played footy against Tony, Buggy you'd see up at the Greyhound track quite regularly, and he was commuting from Ballarat down to St Kilda to train. So our relationship was about footy, but also the greyhound industry. And then when I went and coached over in Tasmania, the Burnie Football Club, quite often we'd take three or four over to the Devonport Greyhounds, which was only about a 20-minute drive, and Ricky Ponting was often there with his greyhounds as an owner. So it was interesting to talk to, you know, icons of both cricket and the footy industry about a passion that the three of us had a love for. But we were spoiled in the view that, fortuitously, I was working at one of Dakes' pubs in Richmond, the old Benton's, Peter Dacos' pub, and we had one guy there who commuted from, Brian Elms was his name. He'd come down from Cranbourne Way, Devon Meadows Way, and he said, oh, do you want to get into the greyhounds? I said, oh, I love the greyhounds. I said, well, you've got something in mind. He said, yeah, mate of his, Caesar Costa. He's just bred this litter by Bright Judge out of Al's Vida. He's got a couple of dogs to get rid of, a couple of bitches to get rid of. Come down and have a look. So I jumped in the car one day and I went down and had a look and I said, oh, I'll pick that one. I'd just like the look of that one. Anyway, we paid $3,000 for it. I rang Hawkey. Hawkey was in for $600. I rang three of my mates in Ballarat. Tony Walker, who I grew up with as a seven-year-old kid, right through our lives, we're best mates. And then Rodney Hanson and, Buck Hanson and Rodney Hanson got involved as well. So that's how the five partnerships started. We all put in $600. We paid $3,000 for this dog unseen. It was a pup, but Caesar thought it reared pretty well and just we backed his faith. And he had probably seven or eight starts with Caesar Costa. They couldn't get out of the boxes. He was at a miss as to why, because he looked after it from a muscle perspective. And he just basically said to us, we can't do any more. If you've got another person in mind, let's have a chat. So I went to the Olympic Park Dogs on a Monday night, which we used to always do, and down in the old dungeon there where people would go downstairs and have a beer, Graham Bate used to stand there a lot. And I got a connection with Graham Bate through the Ballarat days because he'd be there Wednesday night in the bar. He'd go and catch some of his dogs, all that sort of stuff. And the conversation started from there. He said, I'll have a look at him. I'll take him home tonight if you want to get released from Caesar Costa, the dog trainer, because he raced on that Monday night. And from there, the rest is history. He just went on to win, as I said, a Geelong Cup. He went on to win a Melbourne Cup because of Graham Goetz's ability as a dog trainer. He was one of the best I've ever seen.
Mick, when I did that interview, I made mention of the Collingwood's history of not winning trophies. Obviously, they had, but not for a long time. So you were there through the Collywobble period, but it was the very next year that you actually won the premiership. So, you know, fair sentence. Is it fair to say that he brought the winning culture back to some Collingwood members?
That's a very tenuous link, but you could go with it, Mick.
I might go with that. I think we might not. Give the dog the praise for what happened 12 months later, Dad.
On the football field.
That's how you do it. That's where the winning post is.
Yeah. Teammates come out that night at Sandown, and we hung tough upstairs till about 2 o'clock, 2.30 in the morning, celebrating the win. And, you know, what happens off the football field galvanises what happens on the footy field, I reckon. And we had some great mates and supportive mates that weren't even into the Greyhounds. And I remember Dakes, for example. He wasn't a punter as such and never been involved in greyhound ownership or even horse ownership, probably to this day, I think. But he'd come out and support us and, you know, just it was great to see, you know, what I call legends of our AFL industry and Peter Dacos support. He was my hero as a young kid growing up. I wore number 34 in the end and he was number 35. So I had a great relationship with him over the journey, but I was one that always looked up to him when I was in the grandstand as a kid. And for him to show the support that night, to support us to get a greyhound across the line, goes to show what type of culture we had at that period of time. And as we know, the rest is history. 12 months later, happened to beat the Bombers after a 32-year period where Collingwood had no success. It was one of those treasured moments.
Well, it wasn't as tenuous as I thought when Dan asked it. It's actually a very strong link there. Hey, Mick, I think everyone yearns for the past, and I always often think about Olympic Park. We used to trot over there on a Monday night from the Herald building, and you'd see Plugger there in that bar, that dungeon bar, and all that. How big a loss for greyhound racing was, I think a bit of it with Moonee Valley and the trots as well. Has it paid a price for the loss of Olympic Park, or has it advanced since regardless?
I've always felt when you get connected through your time in connection to sport, whether it be ownership or just love going to a venue, when that's taken away, a bit of the heart and soul of an industry is darkened. And I reckon the Meadows was right in the hub of the city. People could make a decision, do I drive there, do I walk there, do I catch transport there? So I think geographics is a huge part of that hub's success. And I felt at the time the Meadows being such a central part of where Melbourne geographically located in Melbourne, it just made it for everyone to get there. And some of the crowds there, you guys would have went there, and it was just massive. The atmosphere was great. You're on top of the greyhound track. You know, you can hear the lure approaching the boxes. It would sizzle down the back, and the dogs would stretch out, obviously, due to checkered runs they'd have. But you felt a part of it. It's a bit like Moonee Valley, you're on top of the racing action when it comes to a Cox Plate. And I sort of resonate with that. And then when it gets taken away from that, you have to travel a bit further, your interest wanes, the crowd drops away. You might be able to bet nowadays online, which everyone tends to do, and not get there in person, which I see it as a social day just as much as a day to go to the races to back a winner. But I think you're right in that. You lose a little bit of your heart and soul when you get connected as a young person growing up and you get to a point of venue regularly. It certainly makes it a little bit disappointing.
Simone would know about this. One of the great success stories in the UK and Ireland was the Dublin Greyhound races, I think, on a Friday night, because they were was right in the heart of town. This was going back 10 years, that it was this amazing social phenomenon in Dublin, was that everyone was going to the Greyhounds, and it was so close to the CBD in Dublin that everyone had spill out of work, and they've decided to all start going to the Greyhounds. Were you aware of that phenomenon of the Dublin dogs because of the location of the track, Mick?
No, I wasn't, Matt. I sort of didn't know much about the overseas greyhound industry at all. I do now because I've seen the influx of, you know, the crossbreed and all that sort of stuff coming into the industry. And I know a couple of mates that are Irish people, and they've always had a connection with the greyhound industry, and they've still got greyhounds racing in Australia and over there today. So I didn't know at the time. I just loved it because of my upbringing, because I had a connection with the animal. My granddad, as I said earlier, he loved the greyhounds. He trained some winners, and with that, probably create some joy and satisfaction with your hard work, walking the dogs daily, morning and night, all that sort of stuff. And you see your granddad have a tender, loving care for the animal. I think it just spirals through you, the grandson. And that's where my love of that come from. And it's not dissimilar to the horsing industry, because we were related to Noel Kelly. Noel Kelly was a fantastic trainer, as you know, Matt, Dan, Simone. And we used to go out to Dowling Forest time after time, and you'd see Smokey floor out there as an apprentice and different people riding their horses. And we had some horses as well, the McGuan family. We actually won a two-year-old race, the Silver Jubilee Stakes, on Cox Plate Day with Pagoda Queen. And probably from that point in time, in 1977, that was the year that Family Man and Raffendale were the two in the Cox Plate that everyone was speaking about. Family Man outpointed Raffendale. And from that day, as a 10-year-old, it sort of gets embedded in your blood to see the joy and the satisfaction of a victory, the country folk taking on the city folk. We beat them by a short half head, and a short half head beat New Rose and Bell Rose. And it just lasts with you forever. You go back to the farm, you have a celebration drink with all your uncles and your aunties and your family members, your cousins and all that sort of stuff. And that's something that just gets embedded in you. And that's the reason why I'm connected to probably all three codes, because I've had trotters as well with your good mate, Kevin Lang, had trotters with Teddy Demler. These guys are synonymous with the industry, as Dan well and truly knows. We lost Gavin, unfortunately, and that was really tough at the time for a lot of people that knew him really well. And I certainly had great times with Gav. But that's the reason why I'm connected to the three codes, because of the people in it.
And Mick, the people in the three codes have absolutely loved you throughout your career as well, because you've had a greyhound and horses trotting and gallops named after you, or some form of McGuan. I remember Alan Britton used to train a greyhound called McGuan. So there's certainly that love from the other side as well, not just your love of the animals in the industry. And Mick, in 1996, there was a horse that won the Ballarat Cup, and it was called McGuan. Let's take a listen.
Redman took the lead. Aphasia on the outside, Idea. Back on the rails, Napier Street, Boheed under the whip. On the outer then comes McGuan from Dark Tsar. And down the outside, Change of Fortune. The red man, Idea, grabbed by McGuan. On the inside, Napier Street. McGuan took the lead. Napier Street, the inside, fighting back. And Boheed, McGuan in front. McGuan's going to get in the cup. McGuan. McGuan, 1.5 length of Boheed. Tight third, Sovereign Lear and Flying Wesley Boy. Then Napier Street.
They named one after you in that race too, Dan. Dark Tsar.
Yeah, there you go. I was chasing tail still at that stage. Simone was about to point out, or she did beforehand, Simone, about having a greyhound, a harness horse. There was a harness horse called M. McGuan. If not, there were others as well, and obviously this McGuan, which is fitting because it's Ballarat Cup Day today.
How does it make you feel when you hear your name, that people are naming their racing animals after you? Is it one of those things where you know, as a kid, you might dream of being famous, and then you become a footballer who's very successful and your name's thrown around everywhere? And is it a bit strange, or is it just like such a great honour to be named McGuan, or have a horse or a greyhound called McGuan? How does it make you feel?
You want them to be fast, Mickey.
You might want to do, mate, don't worry about that. Simone, to answer your question, it's strange, but it's humbling at the same time. But it's also an honour to have a greyhound or a horse named after you. And I was always one for not being attached to sympathy just because someone's named after you. I sort of try to distance myself from the horse itself. I'd love it to do well for its owners. But I remember one day we flew to Sydney and McGuan the horse was racing, and as we got off the plane, all of a sudden, remember the old brick phones you used to carry around? I took it back on your big thick phones with the antenna on top when they first come out the mobile phone.
I didn't have one of those, but I do know what you're talking about.
You had to carry it around in a wheelbarrow, basically.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember turning the phone on. My phone went crazy. I said, what's happened here? Anyway, I answered a few phone calls, and I said, how big? I said, what are you talking about? He said, oh, McGuan's won at 50 to 1. He said, surely you got your field up. I said, mate, I've never seen on it. So I never let the sentiment of having a horse named after you or a greyhound named after you make me back it. But to win the Ballarat Cup and for Robert Smurden, and I'm synonymous with Ballarat in a way because that's where I grew up, but Robert Smurden, Arthur Smurden, Johnny Smurden, they're personal friends of mine. And as a young kid growing up, to see the Smurden family be successful in the racing industry is what they were. It's just magnificent to see. Johnny's still training up at the Gold Coast. Still speak to him regularly. Speak to Robert to touch base how he's going through his ordeal with what he's had to go through over the last couple of years. But notwithstanding that, still keep in contact with people that you grew up with, and to have a horse named after me by McGuan, trained by Smurden, who went on to win a Ballarat Cup. It was really satisfying at the time.
Yeah, and I must admit, I've seen Robert a bit lately and keep in contact, and he's doing relatively well, and I'm really chuffed about that. They did name a harness horse after you, Simone. Don't you remember Dan Sans Simeone?
I only ever got beaten once. So
yeah, it was a champion, Simone. It was a champion.
Hey, oh, thank you.
Mickey, can I ask you a footy-related question? And it's been on my mind for the last 2 years, and Half and I were yakking about it on the radio recently, and I think Gareth and I did as well. And so I've got a 15-year-old son who was a pretty good footballer and really committed footballer, but the disruption to the footy for the last 2 years, he's now found his guitar and his horses, my wallet and other things, and he said, Dad, I've just lost interest. I've lost the connection, and there's a new coach that they don't know. And he said, Dad, half the kids won't want to play, I'm telling you now. And I kept thinking, wow, this is a generation of those important 14, 15-year-old boys and girls who have lost the connection, they've lost the skill upgrade of that important period of the academies and all that. And I just keep thinking, maybe it'll all sort itself out, and it probably will, but I just wonder whether the AFL should be extremely mindful of this potential, not a lost generation of footballers, but a massive disruption to their evolution and whether it will have some impact.
No, it's a great question, Matt, because we're going through that at our local club right now, and we've got close to 800 participants at the Kiowa Footy Club, and we have a huge focus on our junior program to give young boys and girls a chance to live their dream. And my young bloke's 14 and he is driven and he loves his sport, footy, cricket, basketball. But even he said to me at times with his, some of his mates, because of the stop-start nature of the last couple of years, the game of footy probably doesn't mean as much to them as what it did 2 years ago.
And even watching it, when they've been watching the footy, it hasn't felt as big as before with restricted crowds and all that. What, when they're watching it, they're not as inspired by it as they were pre-COVID, maybe?
No, it's that disconnection by going to the MCG or going to a home ground that they haven't been able to do for the last 2 years. The game on tally isn't the same for young boys and girls to watch. So I reckon the AFL have got to make significant inroads into the connection to local football competitions. And how would they do that? I think they have to have strong discussions with their football clubs to get some of the heroes back to the grassroots level, to engage with the younger generation to say, this is what happened when I was doing this. This is the dream that I lived. If for it to become a reality, this is what you have to do. A, B, C, D. You have to work hard, work on your skill acquisition every day. You've got to concentrate on your sleeping patterns. You've got to concentrate on your diet. To give these kids an opportunity to jump in the same vehicle that the bikes that are there now doing it, got on. And if they don't have that disconnect, if they continue to go down the path of having that disconnection, because I'm disappointed with the AFL, I think they've tried to create an elite sport and they've forgotten about grassroots footy. And I think it's something that they really should take strongly on board, because I reckon at local level, when there's a domination of three or four clubs in any competition, I reckon the governance of some of the those leagues, they're trying to create equalisation and trying to make the best come back to the mediocre rather than the mediocre growing and getting better to get to the best. And I think that's a philosophy that's flawed. I don't think it'll hold well for the future generation of our game if that continues to go down the path, because I'm one for saying, if I want to be in the best 22, this is what I've got to do. And that's the type of stuff I do when I teach the kids that I coach. I do seniors on a Saturday. I coach juniors on a Sunday. I've coached under 8 level. I've coached under 10 level. I've coached under 11 level. And this year I coached under 14. We had an undefeated team, but you've got to learn to coach them. The other component that they've got to take into account, because of what people have gone through with COVID, loss of business, loss of job, people are trying to search for new jobs, therefore trying to get coaches, voluntary coaches, to coach an under 10 group, an under 12 group, an under 14 group, an under 16 group, with the right CV attached to it to make sure they can coach the game of footy to get the best out of their kids is hard to do, because work's become a priority. So that's the reason why I think your question is very valid. We are in a very, very important phase of the football industry based on what's been out of our control, and that's the COVID experiment.
And Mick, when you look back to your career, things would have been vastly different. Like you've mentioned, going to the races, footballers are a lot more protected these days, aren't they? There are a lot more stringent guidelines about what they can and can't do. And it seems that, is it hard to relate to the footballers these days, the young kids coming through, because things are so vastly different to how you experienced them?
Well, I think it comes back to your motivation of why you play the great game, Simone. Back then, we had a $1.5 million salary cap in, say, 1990. Nowadays, it's $15 million. So you're talking about what comes with the territory. Back then, you could have a bit of life balance, have a bit of fun, have a beer at the wrong times, try to get away with it. Now, with social media, the scrutiny that's on everyone that has a AFL badge against their name, they get scrutinised, and rightfully so, because some people are walking around putting a jumper on for $1 million every year. So with that comes responsibility. With that comes performance. So I think to put it into one blanket answer, I think it's unfair. I would certainly make the adjustment to say, well, okay, if I'm playing in today's era, I'd certainly make every necessary sacrifice to get the best out of myself to maximise my financial advantage, because the game says it can pay you. Back then, you run around probably for $60,000 to $70,000 at various stages when you're first starting out, less tax. So basically, it was a 9-to-5 job that people would be doing back then, whether they were a plumber, a sparky, whatever it may be. So you still had a chance to live a little bit and have some fun on the side. But nowadays, it's such a professional game. It's got to be treated that way. So if you decide to go down that path for a 10-year opportunity, let's face it, that's the percentage you try to get to, because that's when you're talking about what the elite do to survive the system for that long. That's what you've got to do. You've got to get up every morning, breathe, eat, and make sure you do the work to be the best footballer you can be.
Mick, you mentioned you're involved with the Keilor Footy Club, and you've been there for a while now. President Craig Hill, been a good friend of mine since I was a little kid. We used to run athletics together when we were 7 and 8 years old. How's your relationship with Craig, and how's the club going?
Yeah, Keilor's a fantastic guy. He's obviously breathes the Keilor Footy Club, because close round of games. He was a president for a long period of time. He's not currently the president. He moved on. Some fresh blood come into the footy club. Brad Bolt took over from Tierley. Brad's a successful businessman in his own right. He volunteered a lot of time and effort to, you know, maintain the strong status that the club's held in. And then Craig Hill become the president after Brad Bolt. Spent 2 or 3 years in the chair. And now we've got Ray Sheridan, all successful businessmen, all love the football club, all had kids that have been connected to the footy club in some way. And they just love to see, you know, a young boy or girl be given a great opportunity in a really successful cultural environment to live their dream. And let's face it, there's fun for some, but there's some seriousness for others, and we have to try to cater for both experiences. And there's no better sort of satisfaction. Not only do you try to win a premiership in your registered age group, whether it be men or women or boys or girls at various junior levels, you've got to give them a chance to get to the pathway of TAC Cup. If they get to TAC Cup, they might get drafted. If they don't get drafted, they might get an opportunity by going back to the VFL landscape. Have another couple of good years there. And the history will tell us over the last 12 or 13 years, I think we've had 10 or 11 players that have been picked up out of the Kiwi football program that's gone to Calder, gone to Western Jets. And in 1 year, we had 4 boys drafted, 3 in the top 20, out of one club in 1 year. That to me is really satisfying. That really satisfies our club, satisfies our volunteers, knowing full well that we try to do a lot right by these boys or girls to give them a chance to get to where they want to go.
Well, it certainly sounds like you're still entrenched in the football, Mick, and also in the racing. And with the Melbourne Cup coming up this Friday night, is it something that you do every year? You sit and watch the Melbourne Cup, the Greyhounds, and have a bet?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I just love sitting there on a Thursday night. If we come out of training, you get home by sort of probably maybe race 7 or 8 and the last 4 or 5 races are on, you can sit back and watch it. Usually race 8's the marquee race on the program. It's not dissimilar to listen to Dan's dulcet tones at Melton. Don't get to the track as much because of the complications of coaching juniors and seniors, and Saturdays and Sundays are ruled out, but certainly keep an avid eye on it. I love the spring carnival that we've just witnessed. It's all about the people, it's all about the horse, it's all about the trainer and the jockey, and when you all get everyone on the one page, that's when your ground swell and you see the power of the horse, the power of the greyhound on show. And I think that's what gravitates the watchful eye of many to those industries, because it's a great experience to be involved in. And if you get to a chance to be an owner, it doesn't matter whether it's 1%, 10% or own the horse or greyhound outright, it just gives you a great satisfaction when you see your animal get across the line in first place. It just brings a lot of people together.
And you're one of the very lucky few who have a greyhound with their name up on that honour board at Sandown, with Fair Sentence taking out the 1989 Melbourne Cup. And Mick, it's been wonderful having you on Cracking the Codes this morning. Really appreciate your time and generosity in explaining things about football and racing and where you started. And I'm sure our listeners would have loved the interview this morning. So thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime, Simone. Good on you, Dan. Good on you, Matt.
On you, Mickey.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
What a weekend for the Breeders' Crown racing action at the Harness Racing, Simone. It was a terrific night last night. And this year we're getting to the big ones with the Group 1 action on the Saturday night. It's the second year that we've been on the Saturday night for the Breeders' Crown. A few changes in harness racing over the last couple of years, but I think we're benefiting from that. And guess who our next guest is?
Oh, very VIP, isn't it, Dan? We've got someone very special joining us. He has been on the show before, but it's great that he can give up a little bit of his time on this Saturday morning before a busy day ahead for him. And very pleased to announce that we have got Gareth Hall joining us this morning on Cracking the Codes. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning, Simone and Dan. My favourite show on RSN 927, Cracking the Codes. Every time I wake up on a Saturday morning heading into work, I listen to you guys, and I just had to get up a little early this morning.
Yeah, well, I think it won't hurt him, but at the same time, he's probably one of the most passionate harness racing people I know, and I thought it would be a good idea to have a chat to Gareth in relation to the Breeders' Crown, because it's one of the only race series going around that Gareth's actually older than, because the Breeders' Crown series was initiated in the late 1990s. So it's season 23 for the three-year-olds, but of course the two-year-olds started that 1 year earlier. So 24th season of Breeders' Crown Racing, Gareth.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun over the years. I think my favourite Breeders' Crown moment was on a Sunday afternoon at Ballarat, and I think you called the action. You did, because it was one of the
great horse.
It was one of the great calls, Denny. Yeah, Lombo Pocket Watch, Gavin Fitzpatrick, four back the inside. Somehow he got out of that pocket and won. And you don't see too many grey horses in harness racing. You don't see too many great grey horses in harness racing. But he was one of those, Lombo Pocket Watch. What a superstar he was. And I'll never forget that day.
No, well, it shows you the depth that we get in the Breeders' Crown. I thought that going back about 3 years ago, I was a little concerned about the future. It was placed in late winter. Not that that was a great issue, but you look at the two-year-olds, for example, they would start racing in maybe January, a lot of them into the February or March. And by the time we saw them in August, they'd only had a handful of starts. We didn't know them so well. With the change of the breeding season now, it's now the calendar year, we've got two-year-olds racing tonight that have been racing for the whole year. They're seasoned horses. We know them much better. Punters know them much better. And I think it makes for some very exciting finals.
Totally agree. I think the best thing to happen to harness racing for some time is the change of seasons. I think that it's set up a better open class season, but the juvenile season especially has been superb. I love the Derby and Oaks in the latter part of the year here in Victoria. I know that the Oaks and Derby are still in the early part in New South Wales, which is still exciting because you get to see these latter two-year-olds mainly go on and compete in that Derby series. I think the Winter Carnival in Queensland works well as well. So I think maybe the Breeders' Crown just needs a little bit more breathing space to get some Queensland horses and WA horses. But in saying that, it's probably a little bit too harsh because horses can't travel because of the COVID situation. But no, I like the change of seasons, and as I pointed out, I think it's the best thing that's happened to harness racing.
Eight Group 1s on the card, Simone, and of course on Vicbred Night, which is New Year's Eve now, there's 12 Group 1s, so they're mighty programs. The fields come out earlier on in the week, and we're over the form, back and forth, and you just can't help but revisiting the form guide and trying to find something that you hadn't seen prior, go over some extra replays. It's pretty exciting to do, Gareth.
Well, I love this time of year, and Dan and Simone, I'm a little bit like you. I love all three codes. And especially the greyhound racing of late, I've started to get to know a few of the participants and understand that sport a little bit better. But Friday nights, for the love of me, I can't sleep, Dan and Simone. We had the Melbourne Cup heats last night, of course. We had a terrific night at Melton with some more Breeders' Crown races. And I enjoy doing the form for the Gallop. So, and Gloucester Park is still one of my favourite venues to watch. So Friday nights are impossible for me to sleep. And last night was one of the best Friday nights that you could ever have. So I'm on adrenaline this morning, Simone.
You do sound like it, Gareth. And before we take a listen to a couple of replays of some terrific Breeders' Crown finals, Gareth, what would be the equivalent of a Breeders' Crown in greyhound racing that, to your knowledge? Because the thing that really stumps me in harness racing is there is no Melbourne Cup. I find that probably a very odd race not to have in harness racing. But the Breeders' Crown, what would the equivalent be, do you think?
The Breeders' Crown would be, that's a very good, I don't think we have actually got a Breeders' Crown in greyhound racing. You sort of got the Nationals, which allows every participant around the country to go and compete and represent their state. But maybe that Vic, it's a little bit like the Vic Bread, but that Vic Bread night that they had there at Bendigo recently, where they put up a lot of prize money, something, it's pretty similar to that. But I can't think of a similar race in greyhound racing. Maybe a race for some of the rising stars, like the Great Chase, maybe that series in a way where you get some of the better young greyhounds coming through the ranks. But they haven't got an Australasian type of race, have they? I know the New Zealand doesn't produce the greyhounds that we do here. That's a good question, Simone. Maybe we can have a Breeders' Crown for greyhound racing. I like how they did the Vic Bread. I thoroughly enjoyed that night at Bendigo, and I think that's a big winner. They put a lot of prize money into it, but I think that encourages people to breed locally here in Victoria, and if you can compete for that grade of prize money, I think that's a big tick for mine.
It's something that's really grown, even though it's a restricted type series because it's just for Vic bred horses. There couldn't be a stronger series. I still feel it's the most sought after races in Victoria. We've had this chat before, haven't we, Gareth? And even the Australasian Breeders' Crown, it's open. You've got to pay up for it when the horses are young and they're foals. But with a Vic bred, they've got to be born here or bred from a Victorian sire. In Victoria, but it's made for great racing. It's my favourite time of the year. These series, which would be more akin to say the Magic Millions in the thoroughbred racing, but I think even stronger again because everybody wants that involvement. Everybody wants to be winning those Group One races for 2 and 3 year olds. $300,000 is the prize money for the feature 2 year old events tonight. So there's plenty of prize money up for grabs, Simone.
Certainly is. Well, Dan, you've picked out a couple of replays, and there was one from back in 2017. And I love the fact that the horse raced and won as a two-year-old at that particular time, and he's gone on, and we saw him in the Hunter Cup earlier this year at Melton, and that was King of Swing taking out the Breeders' Crown.
King of Swing in front, Poster Boy hooked out. Sicario winds up, then Tam Major and Colt 31 as Master Moonlight gives ground. King of Swing led, Poster Boy's alongside. Then Sicario, Colt 31 and Tam Major. King of Swing and Poster Boy. King of Swing just in front. Poster Boy ahead away. It's King of Swing from Poster Boy. King of Swing kicks on. King of Swing. King of Swing beat Poster Boy. Colt 31, third, Sicario 4.
I think it's a great advertisement for harness racing when the very best horse in harness racing still today was winning Group 1 races as a two-year-old in King of Swing, Gareth.
He's been a wonderful horse, King of Swing. Now, he was trained in New Zealand when he won that two-year-old Breeders' Crown. And then he went back to New Zealand and he was competitive in some of their bigger races as a 2 and 3 year old. He was purchased by Gary Hall Sr.'s clients for... I think landed in Perth. Now, I think Senior told me this after I filled him up with a couple of scotches there one night in Perth. For about $500,000 he cost. And when he first arrived in Perth, he won a WA Derby. But he seemed to just struggle when he was off the fence. And he used to, dare I say it, he used to put the white flag up pretty easily when things weren't going his way. But then he went over to Luke McCarthy, and we all know what's happened there when he went to Luke and Belinda McCarthy's. He's loved Menangle. He won a Hunter Cup. He's won a couple of Miracle Miles. He's the favourite for the Inter-Dominion. So he's been a wonderful, resilient horse to do what he's been able to do from a Breeders' Crown two-year-old to be Australia's number one open-class pacer now for a season and a bit. Lochinvar Art was better than him, but since he's been injured, he's become the number one seed.
And, of course, that Inter-Dominion starts next week, would you believe? So it's right on our doorstep.
Well, that's our Melbourne Cup, isn't it, Dan? That is our Melbourne Cup. But unfortunately,
well, it is, but I'm just worried about where it's going with New Zealand pulling out of the Inter-Dominion Council and what we've seen of the Inter-Dominion in the past. Well, we're in for it. The next few years are going to be telling as to the future of that series.
That's been the biggest disappointment in my time following the sport of harness racing. I see how great the TAB Melbourne Cup is, Simone. Like, you speak to Anthony as a party, he's crying before he even wins it when we interviewed him that before the box draw with Whiskey Wright that year. Then you've got other races around it that are probably worth a little bit more prize money now than the TAB Melbourne Cup, but trainers still want to win that race. It's their holy grail. Where harness racing, it's always been the most marketable race, the Inter-Dominion, but because Harness Racing Australia, and this is its flaw in a way, and it's probably, it can't do too much about it, but it doesn't have the power over the other states, and no one really wants to put money into a race that is competed in a different state than theirs. So they've really lost the way that the Inter-Dominion should be run and held and how it should be presented these days. I think it's still got some time to save it, but it's been our number one race since I was growing up. And I felt that the sport and the administrators in a way have let it down a little bit, Dan, for mine.
Yeah, it's going to be telling the next few years. There's no doubt about that. One more replay to look at. We've hopefully warmed you up before you start talking to the trainers for Ballarat Cup Day, Gareth. This horse won one Group 1 race, and this was it. I think you'll remember his name.
It's Ride High, the leader, 28-1 the third quarter. Leads 2 metres, Poster Boy. Ignatius called on now. Colt 31 is awaiting the Garrard Sprint Lane. Turning for home, Ride High, 3 metres. Colt 31's about to get the run from Poster Boy. Ride High's in front of Colt 31. Ride High has kicked away and has them covered. Ride High draws away. An emphatic win. Ride High first beat Colt 31. Third was Poster Boy, fourth home, major time.
Yeah, Ride High. It's his only Group 1 win, and of course he was recently retired, Gareth, and what a great shame, because he was one of the most exciting horses that we've seen in many a day, and he took out the 2018 edition. It was the same crop that King of Swing had beaten the year before, Simone.
Well, I'm not 100% sure on that, Dan. I know you're the stats man with the harness racing, but I just wanted to add something little into that. We didn't hear the horse's name being called Diamonds and Cash, but he was actually in that Breeders' Crown with Ride High, and I think he finished about fifth. Now, Diamonds and Cash was the horse that, when my daughter Darcy wanted to get into pony trots, we went to Andy and Kate Gath's property, and she actually drove Diamonds and Cash around. I didn't know, because he was one of the quietest horses on the property, and she actually drove him a little bit by herself with one of the stable hands walking beside her. But I didn't know that he was a horse that had been in a Group 1, so we didn't hear him in the following final stages of the call, but he was certainly in there, so I enjoyed watching that replay as well. But Ride High, I do remember him. He was always making headlines, wasn't he? He's a terrific horse. But surprising that he's only won the one Group 1. I heard his name that many times, I thought he'd probably won about 10 of them.
Well, we can spruik a horse sometimes in harness racing, and Ride High was purchased. And good on Alibar. They spent a little bit of money, but then the PR operation started with Ride High. Like, he did smash the clock, but he never really defeated much throughout his career. And he could have been a superstar. He could have been the Christian Cullen, a popular arm of the sport, Dan, but we just won't know, unfortunately.
No, we won't. It is unfortunate, but his name is on the honour roll of winning a Breeders' Crown. And
he was very, very good. He was very good.
Yep. He was. Well, I hope you're all warmed up, Gareth.
I am.
And I hope the entree was delicious.
I love this
show. The main course you're about to serve up is equally as tasty.
I can't believe you get Matty Stewart up this early on a Saturday morning. You do extremely well there.
Yeah, I think he does it with his eyes closed.
He does.
But nonetheless.
No, it's a lot of fun, guys. Love the show. And, looking forward to another really big weekend. We've got the Inter-Dominion, the Melbourne Cup on Friday night. And the Zipping Classic should be a beauty. Jamie Carr's back in action. So,
Looking forward to getting back to metropolitan racing as well.
It never ends these days, guys. Have a wonderful day. Craig's winding me up. Said, Gareth, you've got to get to your show's about to start. Johnny Bowden's yelling at me. He said, Gareth, hurry up.
Thanks for joining
Siri's
us, Gareth.
And telling me to shut up as well. See you later.
You'll be on Trot's Vision later on, and of course through Sky Racing as well tonight.
Look forward to it.
At Melton. Enjoy your day.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Simone.
And to all our listeners, enjoy your day too. Look forward to your company next Saturday morning on Cracking the Codes.